Well, today I'd like to talk about Elijah. And what I like to draw from Elijah is not only his strengths, but his humanness. And we realize that God can use any one of us. And like I say, it's not that he was such a titan as much as God used him and he was willing to let God use him. The story that I want to kind of go through ranges from 1 Kings 16 to 2 Kings 2. And that's the whole story. And we won't cover every detail of it. And I encourage you to read that. There's so many nuggets there that I want to bring out a couple of them. And you think, well, why is that on your radar, Ed? And one of the reasons was because when I retired and we went to Israel in 2014, one of the things that turned that whole trip around for me was to realize that when we were sitting on Mount Carmel, that this is where Elijah had to battle with the beasts or the priests and the prophets of Baal. And one of the reasons that it struck me so much was that, was that we had just traveled from the Red Sea. We had traveled by bus. We had traveled from the morning down on the Red Sea up to Beersheba, and then from Beersheba up to the valley where David fought Goliath, and then from the valley, and that was probably around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and then we went from there to Tel Aviv. And the next day, then, after staying on the Mediterranean, we went up to Tiberias, and then a day or so later, we wound up on Mount Carmel. Now, one of the things I found somewhat discouraging about Israel was that on a lot of these sites, I wanted to see what it was like that Jesus had to put up with or what was back then. And you'll find on an awful lot of these sites, you'll find big churches, monasteries, temples, you name it. And so you don't really get the flavor for what was back in Jesus' time. There are some exceptions to that. And some of the exceptions were in Nazareth. There's a garden also set up there by Golgotha. And so you did get some visions of what it was like in Jesus' time. But on Mount Carmel, there's a big, I think it's a Greek monastery there. And so you don't get that feeling. But it hit me. We had just traveled by bus from the Red Sea all the way up to, and it took 5-6 hours of traveling. And it hit me that here Elijah, after having God inspire him and doing the battle for him against the prophets, he gets afraid and he takes off and he runs. He runs to Jezreel and beats Ahab, the king. Well, that's a little over a marathon. And so in distance, it was about 30 miles. He continues on down to Beersheba, which is roughly another 100 miles. There, he pretty well collapses, and the angel comes and gives him bread and water. And he does it a second time. And then we're told that in 1 Kings 19, verse 8, so he arose and ate and drank and went on the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now, if you remember one of my other talks, I talked about Mount Horeb being in Midian, that when the burning bush incident with Moses, that God told Moses once he got his people from Egypt to bring them back to this mountain. So that's what I'm saying. When you look at that whole sequence of coming from all the way up in Mount Carmel, down to Beersheba, out into the wilderness a day, and then the angel taking care of him, that he then goes to Mount Horeb. And in the end of that story, he's told to go to the wilderness of Damascus. That's over a 500-mile trip. And I'll tell you, some of that terrain is really rough. But let's step back a little bit because I'm getting a little bit ahead of my story. Some of the other significant things about Elijah is that he's one of those in the Bible that we hear, that we see, raise somebody from the dead. We also see that he was one of the three that was at the transfiguration of Jesus. And he's only one of three that I remember being recorded in the Bible that fasted for 40 days. So that puts him in a fairly unique group. And like I say, we have the account of Moses in Exodus 34, 28, or 27 to 28. And I'll read. Then the Lord said to Moses, write down these words, for in accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel. So he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He did not eat bread nor drink water. He wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. And then, of course, we have that same, I'll say task, but it was the same experience with Jesus. We find that in Mark chapter 1, 9 to 13, where once Jesus is baptized, it says, in those days, starting in verse 9, it says, in those days Jesus came from Nazareth to Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. Immediately coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens open and the Spirit like a dove descending upon him. And a voice came out of the heavens, you are my beloved Son, in you I am well pleased. Immediately the Spirit impelled him to go into the wilderness. And he was in the wilderness 40 days, being tempted by Satan. And he was with the wild beasts and the angels that were ministering to him. So let's step back and try to get a little bit more perspective, because where does Elijah fit in history? And of course, the king that he became very afraid of, or at least his wife he was afraid of, was Ahab. Now, Ahab reigned in northern Israel from 918 BC to 998 BC. Excuse me, 898 BC. So you see that from the time of Abraham at about 2000 BC, the time of the Exodus about 1450 BC, and now we have this at about 900 BC, that you're somewhere in the middle of the kings. There was Ahab and his father Amri were in this time frame. They were the fifth and sixth king in a line of 19 for northern Israel. And the reason I bring that up is because we look at that time frame, and one of the things that's mentioned in the scriptures is that Amri was more evil than all the other kings before him. And then that is repeated for Ahab. Ahab is even more evil than his father. And I liken that to, you look at the time and they had idols and the prophets of Baal and Jezebel and Ahab. It was an evil time. And I look at the time that we're going into in the near future, and you can see that same kind of thing, what people want and what they appear to worship are things we find abhorrent, and I'm sure that God does too. So, let me catch up with my thoughts here a second. Okay, it says I'm in 1 Kings, and I'm in 16:29. Now Ahab, the son of Amri, became king over Israel in the 39th year of Asa, king of Judah. Ahab, the son of Amri, reigned over Israel in Samaria for 22 years. Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord, more than all who were before him. Now, one thing I missed in that story that I wanted to bring out, because, you know, we hear about Samaria, and I didn't catch until I read this in the studying for this that his father, Omri, bought a hill, and he bought the hill, and then he built a city on it. And the city he built there was Samaria. So now, like I say, in history, we have Samaria being an area where most of the Jews avoided and everything else. But here we actually have the naming of Samaria. Okay, so back to the next part of the story is that we see that Elijah, through the word of God, is predicting no rain or basically a drought. And here's another significant thing that I think we need to put in perspective. Here we have a man who is now taken care of by God directly through ravens and a certain brook. Now, I'm in chapter 17 now, verse 1. Now, Elijah the Tishbite, who was of the settlers of Gilead, said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, surely there shall be no neither dew nor rain these years, except by my word." And the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "Go away from here and turn eastward and hide yourself in the brook of Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. And it shall be there that you drink of the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to provide for you there." So he went there and did according to the word of the Lord, for he went and lived by the brook Cherith, and which was east of the Jordan. And the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he would drink from the brook. And it happened, after a while, the brook dried up, and because there was no rain in the land. So here now we have another transition in the story, and we find that Elijah is instructed, and I apologize because I probably should have pointed out that in the King James Version, it's not called Elijah, it's Elisha. Okay, so in verse 8, then it says, "Then the word of the Lord came to him, saying, Arise and go to Zarephath." Now, Zarephath is back up on the Mediterranean above Mount Carmel, which belongs to Sidon. "And stay there, and behold, I have commanded a widow to provide for you." So he arose and went to Zarephath, and when he came to the gate of the city, behold, a widow was gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, "Please give me a little water in a jar that I may drink." And she was going to get it. And he called to her and said, "Please bring me a piece of bread in your hand." Now this is a verse I want you to pay attention to. In verse 12, she says, "But she said, as the Lord your God, I have no bread, only a handful of flour in a bowl and a little oil in a jar. And I'm gathering a few sticks that I may go and prepare for me and my son that we may eat it and die." Now we think of Abraham and him in sacrificing Isaac, or the attempted sacrifice, as being a person of great faith. Here we don't even know what the woman's name is. But think about her mindset. Her mindset is they're destitute. They're about to starve to death. And so here comes a man of God. And she has enough faith to go ahead and listen to him and give him what she thinks is the last of her flour and the last of her oil. I think to me, that just sets in there that's something I have missed all these years. I had never really put that in perspective as to just how much faith that she had. So, index further on in the story. And so she takes care of Elijah. And, of course, Elijah tells her that the flour will never cease and the oil will never give out until it rains. And in this time where she's there, he's there with her for a while, that her son gets extremely sick and, in fact, dies. And she goes in verse 18 and says to him, so she said to Elijah, What do I have to do with you, O man of God? You have come to me to bring my iniquity to remembrance and to put my son to death. So obviously in the story we read that Elijah takes the son, and on three separate occasions or three times he lays with the son, with the child, and he prays to God, and God brings him back to life. So like I said, we have a man that's basically taken and done battle with 400 or 800, prophets of Baal. He does battle with the king and Jezebel. He's taken care of by ravens and brook. He's taken care of by a widow. He raises somebody from the dead. And so now we have, I'm going to continue on the story. I've told you some of it, but I'm trying to put it in perspective the way Scripture spells it out. And so it says in verse 8, in chapter 18, verse 1, it says, now it happens after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year. So now we're talking the third year of this drought. And he says, go and show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the face of the earth. So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now there's another character in this too, because Ahab sends one of his servants, Obadiah, out to search for him. And Ahab goes out searching for Elijah too. He wants him bad. And what we don't get other than till into this story is that Obadiah has gone against Jezebel. And matter of fact, he saved 100 of God's prophets in two separate caves. And it says, in groups of 50, he brought food and water to them for a while. So, Elijah goes to Obadiah and he says to tell Ahab that, I will come and of course Obadiah basically is afraid that if Elijah doesn't live up to his word, that King Ahab is going to take it out on Obadiah and kill him. But we do know the story. We do know that Elijah does go. And he challenges Ahab and the 450 priests. And as a matter of fact, they go and get the 400 other priests or prophets from Jezebel's group. So there's 850 total. And we know the story of the fact that they make two altars and they slaughter this bull and they put the parts on the thing. And the challenge is, call on your God to bring fire so that we can have the sacrifice. And he lets the prophets go first. And of course they do their chant. They cut themselves. They do all kinds of dancing. They do all kinds of things that just, I would say, that pagans would do or think that that's going to help. And Elijah must have had some fun because he was taunting them too. And then we read that toward evening, time of evening sacrifice, Elijah then takes his altar where the bull is sacrificed on and has a moat put around it, and he dumps water on it and fills the moat with water. And then he prays to God. And what we see is God bringing lightning down. I mean, it's just an instant fire. And it burns it all up. That's got to be so striking to everybody that was there. that what we see is the next instance, Elijah commands the people that are there to take all these prophets, false prophets, down to the river Gishon, which is right there at the base of this of Mount Carmel, and they slay him. And the point being is that, so here we have, he's been taken care of by animals, he's been able to raise people from the dead, he's been able to slay all these prophets, and now the next part of the story is he hears word from Jezebel that she's going to have him killed. Now, if she was really intent on doing that, other than causing him grief, you would have thought she wouldn't have warned him, but she did. And so at this point, he takes off running. And like I say, it's a distance of a little over a marathon. And he beats King Ahab on a chariot down. And of course, I've read commentaries and they talk about, well, you know, with the rains and stuff, you would have had mud and everything else. And I'll guarantee you from being in Israel and some of these places, camel travel and little carts and stuff or chariots are really rough. And if you go very fast, you're going to beat yourself to death. That's an aside, but okay. So after this, then of course the rains do come. And we've got Elijah. And I think in my opening I said that Elijah flees all the way to Beersheba. That's roughly 130 miles. He collapses. Angel takes care of him. Goes to Mount Horeb. And I think it's fascinating there. And we'll pick the story up there again because what we see is that Elijah's hiding in a cave. Now, we're several hundred miles away from where Jezebel would be, but he's still hiding there. And, of course, he's lamenting. In Elijah's mind, he's the only one. As a matter of fact, he says this to God, I'm the only one that still worships you. I'm the only one that has served you. And God says to him, Elijah, what are you doing here? And I find that interesting because the other place that we see something like that is when God talks to Noah. And he says to Noah, come into the ark. He didn't say go into the ark. He says come into the ark. So we see instances where we have God talking to a person and telling them to come. And what you take from it is God's already there. And so the part of this is that God tells him, no, you're not the only one left. I have 7,000 others. But the point being is that here we have a man in the form of Elijah, who obviously has been taken care of by God. He has had providential treatment, protection, and yet he's still human. He still has the fears. And I know I've talked to some of our evangelists and some of the other people, including myself. It's amazing how in some instances you can be so strong and in other instances you can be so weak. You know, and the point being is regardless, if you're willing and if you make yourself available, God can use you. And that's our task, is let God use us. I mean, the joy that we have every day. I mean, today's a great day outside, right? Today's a great day even if it was raining and miserable outside. Because we have the Lord. We have the hope in our heart. And I don't know how to put it any other way other than that those of us that are Christians have such a much better, I'll say, outlook on life than the pagan or the non-believer can possibly have. When we have one of our saints die, we can look forward to seeing them again. They look at it like it's been lost for eternity and they can't take anything with them. Well, we can't take anything materially other than our children and grandchildren. And we ought to be talking to them so they have the same hope that we have. Now, my time's up, so I encourage you to read that, 1 Kings 16 through 2 Kings 2. That's a great story. And the only part that I've left out is where Elijah then passes the baton to Elisha. And the thing about where he's talking to God and that he's not in the earthquake, he's not in the fire, he's not in the wind, but he's in a quiet voice. The thing that I think we need to recognize is that God is extremely powerful. He has the ability to protect us. We shouldn't feel the fear that a non-believer would fear. I realize that we're going to have sometimes doubts. We'll have sometimes hesitations. But I contend that when we read things about, like the prophets, it's not so much that they were men of great faith as they were men of faith in a great God. And I think that that's what we have to look at, that if we make ourselves available, God can use us. And that's where we ought to be. And you get a chance to stand up here and talk to the audience about your favorite subjects. It's just, there's a joy in life that you just can't get any other way. I thank you for today. And now if we have a song of invitation.